Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. When you stop for a moment and think about it, you realize we're living in really unbelievable and unpredictable times. As far as the world scene is concerned, we are living in the midst of a pandemic, the likes of which have not been seen since the Spanish influenza 100 years ago, and the entire world is suffering. As far as Israel's relationship with the United States is concerned, the relocation of the American embassy to Jerusalem has taken place 25 years after the U.S. Congress recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and the U.S. has recognized the Golan Heights as part of Israel, among other things. We are in the midst of arranging peace with three Arab Muslim countries, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The Sudan is probably the most interesting and surprising because that is the place where the Muslim countries declared there would be no peace with Israel, the famous three no's, including no peace and no recognition. And these peace agreements have revealed several important facts that have apparently been just beneath the surface but are now visible. One is that the Arab Muslim countries are more concerned with how the peace can benefit themselves, particularly in light of the threat from Iran. It also shown that the Arab countries have been paying lip service to the Palestinian cause and could actually not care less about the Palestinians. It's also revealed how the Palestinian leadership is not interested in anything except lining their own pockets and do not care about the plight of the average Palestinian. And it has revealed how the Arab parties in the Israeli Knesset are not interested in peace and are not interested in what is good for Israel. This latter is of particular interest, and there will probably be more developments from this realization. There is an old Chinese curse. I hope you don't live in quiet times. It may become a Jewish blessing. I'll be back after the break.
The return of the Jewish people to the land of Israel was prophesied in the Bible thousands of years ago and is coming true today. Shalom. Join me, Josh Wander, on Israel Unplugged. Listen in as we delve into the spiritual and physical aspects of the Jewish return to Zion. We'll discuss the biblically mandated, historic, and of course practical understandings of this incredible transition from exile to redemption. That's Israel Unplugged, every Monday on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again. Israel has signed peace agreements with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and now Sudan, all brokered by the Trump administration. By taking a robust approach to some of the region's more difficult issues, such as relocating the American embassy to Jerusalem, the United States has produced a number of profound changes to the regional landscape, the consequences of which are all likely to be felt for many years to come. The breakthrough in the peace process, moreover, has resulted in the region being clearly divided now between moderate, peace-loving countries that are prepared to engage in the peace process and, on the other hand, rejectionist regimes such as Turkey and Iran, that are only interested in causing more trouble. These are the facts on the ground. When it comes to confronting the many challenges that face the modern Middle East, the United States has proved itself to be truly inspirational at leading during the last 4 years. From achieving a remarkable breakthrough in the Israeli-Arab peace process, to curbing the malign activities of Iran's Islamic Revolution in this region, the United States has already succeeded in establishing a legacy that is the envy of many of previous administrations. A succession of American presidents from Ronald Reagan to Barack Obama have attempted and failed to break the endless cycle of violence that has come to characterize this region. And it has only been the current style of U.S. leadership that has made an impact on the landscape of the Middle East. The United States has managed to achieve these profound changes, moreover, at a time when the omens were less than auspicious than they were when the current American administration began in 2017. Back then, the region was in the midst of a bitter war against the Islamic fanatics who had seized control of large parts of northern Syria and Iraq and were attempting to impose their form of government, a barbaric form of government, on the inhabitants of the so-called caliphate. It was mainly thanks to decisive American action in fighting the jihadis that the American-led coalition was finally able to inflict a devastating defeat against the ISIS fanatics. Soon after his inauguration, the American president dramatically revised the rules of engagement that had been in place under the prior administrations, which had severely limited the ability of coalition forces to target ISIS terrorists. As a result, the U.S.-led coalition was able to achieve its goal of destroying the caliphate and the ISIS fanatics to the extent today that caliphate has been reduced to rubble. For good measure, by the way, the U.S. even succeeded in eliminating Bakr al-Baghdadi, the mastermind of the ISIS reign, who, while thousands more have been killed or faced being brought to justice. These are the facts on the ground. Indeed, it could be argued that the decisive action of America has redefined the map of the Middle East, drawing a distinction between moderate pro-Western Arab governments like the Gulf states that are moderate and stable, and those such as Iran, Turkey, and Syria that seek to sow discord and unrest. Washington's peace initiative with the Taliban is another area where the administration's very different approach to Afghanistan's long-running civil war has surprised its critics. While the negotiations between the Taliban and the Afghan government still have a long way to go before some kind of peace agreement is signed, the fact is that Washington has been able to sign an agreement with the prospect of ending 2 decades of continuous conflict. This is a significant achievement, one that will enable the American president to fulfill his pledge to reduce America's military presence in other countries. Another area, by the way, where decisive U.S. action has had a dramatic impact on the region is the American insistence on withdrawing from the flawed nuclear deal with Iran and reimposing sanctions against the mullahs. This has had a devastating impact on Tehran's ability to meddle in the affairs of its Arab neighbors and to threaten Israel. With the Iranian economy crippled by sanctions, the regime no longer has the resources available to continue financing its terrorist infrastructure throughout this region at the same level it did previously. So they've carefully targeted assassinations has dealt a significant blow to Tehran's ability to destabilize the region. It is a remarkable breakthrough, though, that the current U.S. administration has achieved in the Arab-Israeli peace process that will stand probably as the crowning achievement of the administration of President Trump. As a result of untiring efforts made by the president's son-in-law to break the impasse in the peace process, Israel is now having signed agreements with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, and Sudan has just followed suit this week. And other countries are apparently giving serious consideration to following suit. Major diplomatic breakthroughs of this nature would have been considered unthinkable when the American administration, the Trump administration, first came into power. By taking a robust approach to some of the region's more intractable issues, such as relocating the American embassy to Jerusalem, the United States has produced a number of profound changes in the landscape in this region, and obviously the consequences of which are likely to be felt for many years to come. The breakthrough in the peace process, moreover, has resulted in the region being clearly divided between moderate, peace-loving countries that are prepared to engage in the peace process because actually they have no problem with Israel. The Sudan and the Arab Emirates and Bahrain, they do not border on Israel. They have no argument with Israel. They seem to be just going along what was the fashion in the Muslim countries, to be an enemy of Israel. They have much more to gain by making peace with Israel, particularly the Sudan, which is a country in bad financial shape, and its relationship to Israel can only help to improve its situation. So it's so, and not so much that they're peace-loving countries. I think that's too strong a word. I think there are countries that have to look out for their own best interests, and their best interests are in making peace with Israel and not supporting the Palestinians. On the other hand, you have rejectionist regimes like Turkey and Iran that are only interested in causing further trouble. It's those countries that apparently the president will point to in his re-election campaign, which right now, this week, is really going full blast. Of course, you have to ask yourself an interesting question. That is, how much are Americans living in Pennsylvania and Ohio or Indiana or any other state interested in what the president has been able to accomplish in the Middle East? They're more worried about their own economic conditions, their own jobs, their own economic future, that's for sure. But there is no doubt that the president can point to what he's done in the Middle East as an achievement not only in and of itself, but the fact that until the Trump administration got involved, what he has done was totally unthinkable, not under any other previous president and under any other previous administration. So, again, it's... The United States has been a real leader in the Middle East. And again, as I said a moment ago, how much will this count when the average American who worries about his own economic future goes into the polling booth? So we here in the Middle East obviously can only heap praise upon what the United States administration has done. Whether it will affect the results of the election, we'll know better in another week, I guess, or another week and a half. But I wanted to touch upon these things and to remind the listeners of what has been accomplished in the last 3.5 years that was totally unthinkable. and inconceivable just before President Trump took office. So we're living in extremely interesting times, and at the moment, they're not just interesting, but they seem to be inspirational and maybe leading toward peace, which of course would be a good thing. I'll be back after the break.
Hi everyone, this is Andrea Simintow from Jerusalem, inviting you to drop everything and join me on my show, Pull Up a Chair. We'll visit this week's quirky stories, meet fabulous guests, and discover my Israel. Together we'll laugh, shout, and explain the topics that make us say, hey, we've got to talk about that. So get comfortable and pull up a chair with me, Andrea Simintow, every Thursday on Israel News Talk Radio.
Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Did you know this psalm and many others were composed by a Jewish shepherd and musician who later became a king? Would you like to know some of the inner meanings of psalms to help you connect with God and strengthen your soul? An exciting and easy-to-read book is now available, which will help you do just that. Software for the Soul, Psalms for Everyone, available on Kindle, Audible, and Amazon.com. Software for the Soul.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
We're back with Jay Shapiro. In the previous segment of the program, I spoke about the fact that Israel has signed peace agreements with three Arab countries, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and now Sudan. And I noted also that none of these countries has a border with Israel. And to the best of my knowledge, they never sent troops to fight against Israel. Now I want to say a few words about something which is a little bit under the headlines and you don't hear much about it, and that is how the Palestinian Authority reacted to the agreements and also how the Arab parties in the Israeli Knesset have responded to the agreements. Let's start first with the Palestinian Authority. The authority officially said that it condemns and rejects the normalization of relations between Arab countries and Israel. A statement was issued by the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah that said that normalization with Israel is in violation of the Arab Summit resolutions and the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative. This statement from the Palestinian Authority was published hours after the announcement that now Sudan and Israel have agreed to normalize their relations. Previous statements by the Palestinian Authority condemned the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain for agreeing to establish relations with Israel, and they really sharply criticized the two Gulf states, who in turn criticized back at the Palestinian Authority. So the statement by the Palestinian Authority, however, did not accuse Sudan of betraying the Palestinians or stabbing the Palestinian people in the back, as was the case with the UAE and Bahrain. So I'm not quite sure why that happened or why that is, but it's important to note it. It might mean something. The statement by the Palestinian Authority also added that no one has the right to speak on behalf of the Palestinian people, and the path to a just and comprehensive peace should be based on international law and legitimacy so as to end the Israeli occupation of the land of the State of Palestine and achieve independence for the Palestine people in their state with East Jerusalem as its capital on the 1967 borders. The Palestinian leadership will take the necessary decisions to protect the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people, unquote. So this is how the Palestinian Authority is reacting. Interesting again, that they didn't say anything about Sudan. While not in the official Palestinian Authority statement, various leaders from the Palestinian Liberation Front, which is a small faction in the Palestinian Liberation Organization, said that Sudan joining others who normalize ties with the State of Israel's occupation represents a stab in the back of the Palestinian people and the betrayal of the just Palestinian cause. Also, a senior official of the ruling Fatah faction in the Palestinian Authority said that Sudan would not gain anything from normalization with Israel. Now, there were several other organizations who spoke up. There's the Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. They condemned the Israeli-Sudan normalization agreement. By the way, they refer to it as a normalization agreement, not a peace agreement. I quite honestly have to check how this agreement is actually defined. I'm not quite sure of the subtle difference between peace and normalization, but it might mean something. I have to check into it. So these terror organizations, it said, for example, we express our condemnation and outrage over the despicable and humiliating normalization that does not suit Sudan's people and history. They said, Hamas said, we call on the heroic people of Sudan to reject the shameful agreement and the establishment of any ties with the criminal enemy, Israel. Now, this is interesting, by the way, because obviously Sudan is not normalizing its relation with Israel because of love of Israel. Apparently, there's something in it for them. I don't know what the details are. Probably some support from the American government, because Sudan is in very bad financial state, as opposed, for example, to the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain that are quite wealthy. So there's different reasons why these different Arab countries are making a peace with Israel. Really, there's a lot to it. There's several layers to it. They went on to say that that is the terrorist group, the Palestinian terrorist groups went on to say the agreement jeopardizes Sudan's future and identity, its betrayal of the Arabs and the Muslims. On the other, that's their statement, but now I'm starting to wonder how much the Sudanese are getting out of this, because they're, as I said, they're in bad shape, and obviously they're getting something out of this agreement. There are two political factions in the Sudan, one's called the Sudanese RT and the Popular Congress Party, the Sudanese Baath Party. I don't know much about them except they issued statements condemning the Sudanese government's decision to normalize relations with the Jewish state. However, The statement welcomes Sudan's removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. So right away, you see, one of the things that Sudan is getting is removal from the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. So it's very interesting. As I said a moment ago, the Sudanese are not doing this out of love of Israel. There were other comments on this agreement from the Arab world. For example, the president of Egypt, El-Sisi, who tweeted that he welcomed the joint efforts of all three states involved in the agreement. And he added that he also values all efforts aimed at achieving regional stability and peace. So, I mean, to the Egyptians, regional stability is a prime thing. So what I spoke to up to now in this segment of the program is about how Palestinian Authority is reacting to these agreements. Now I want to say something about the way that the Israeli Arab political parties who are represented in the Israeli Knesset, they're called the Joint List. It's several small Arab parties which realize that if they run separately, they won't get into the Knesset because they won't have enough votes. They join together in something called the Joint List. So they don't particularly like each other, but they got together because they wanted to make sure they got seats in the Knesset. So what happened was this week that the Joint List of Arab parties roundly condemned the normalization deal between Israel and the Sudan. And one of the former chairmen of one of the parties that makes up the Joint List called for the Sudanese people to overthrow their government because of the agreement with Israel. So the Arabs who sit in the Knesset are not too happy about the agreement. Several Joint List members of Knesset denounced the deal for ignoring the conflict with the Palestinians and said that only the establishment of a Palestinian state would lead to real peace in the region. And even immediately after the announcement of the normalization agreement with Sudan came, another leader of this Joint List tweeted that I condemn Sudan's agreement with Israel, which comes at the expense of the Palestinians. I'm sure the Sudanese people oppose it and will depose those who signed it. If Sudan is not the United Arab Emirates, there is strong opposition to the agreement. Now, this points to the fact, which is apparently true, that the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, the people there are quite happy to have an agreement with Israel. It benefits them. While it could well be that there are strong groups within the Sudan who are opposed to the agreement. In the meantime, as I mentioned, the Joint List, which sits in the Israeli Knesset, condemns the agreement. So that gives you an idea about their way of thinking. As a matter of fact, the head of the Joint List said that the Trump Netanyahu axis of evil was seeking to obtain recognition of Israel's occupation through the bribery of benighted regimes. So this is a reference report to reports of the United States pressure Sudan into the normalization with Israel in return for removing it from a list of state sponsors of terror, which could well be. Also, there are reports regarding the sale of F-35 fighter jets to the United Arab Emirates as part of its normalization deal with Israel. In other words, these states are doing it for their own purpose and their own good. And they don't really care about the Palestinian Arabs. And the Palestinian Arab leadership realize this, and they're very unhappy. So I just wanted to cover what's happening in response to these agreements. I'll be back after the break.
Are you interested in transforming your life, drawing closer to the Creator, and uncovering the deeper meanings and hidden treasures in the Hebrew Bible?
Then join me, Rav Yitzhak Michelson.
And me, William Hall.
On The Science of Kabbalah, where we are seeking to narrow the gap between what we understand of our physical and spiritual worlds. So make sure to tune in every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I'm changing the subject completely now to one that is, at the moment, under the radar, but will become more prominent, I believe, in the coming days. And that is the following. that the Trump administration enabled Israel to annex the Jordan Valley as part of the agreement that was worked out with the Trump team. However, this was suspended when Israel signed agreements with the other Arab countries like United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, and part of the conditions for the signing was that Israel does not further settlement or annex the Jordan Valley. Now, in lieu of annexation, the settlers are pressuring the prime minister to legalize outposts. They're pressing the prime minister to either authorize outposts or at the very least to allow their de facto legalization in lieu of the annexation promise that's been suspended. Now, what are these outposts? The outpost phenomenon began in the mid-1990s at the time of the Oslo Accords, when there was an understanding that Israel would refrain from authorizing new settlements, but settlers, with the tacit support of the government and the army, continued to build new hilltop communities that became known as outposts. Now, the Bush administration secured a pledge from then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to demolish the outposts, but Sharon never made good on the promise, although during his tenure, they were branded as illegal by a report that was put out by the government in 2005. Now, this report counted some 100 outposts and described the collusion of government departments and their illegal construction. And a lull in outpost construction followed this report. However, settlers and right-wing politicians worked to rebrand the outposts. Instead of illegal, they were referred to as communities awaiting authorization. The settlers argued that far from being illegal, the tacit support of government and the army should be viewed as initial nods toward authorization. In 2012, that argument received a boost through a government decision to transform three outposts into legal settlements. That same year, a government commission headed by former Supreme Court Justice Edmund Levy recommended legalizing all the outposts, and after it, the settlers began once again to build outposts. By the way, I have a copy of the Edmund Levy report. It was written back in 2005, and it clearly explains why these outposts are not illegal under any law. According to the left-wing group called Peace Now, some 42 West Bank outposts have been built in the last 8 years, including 28 during the time of the U.S. President Donald Trump's administration. Now, Netanyahu, the prime minister, also approved the authorization of outposts as neighborhoods of settlements. That is a move that allowed for their legalization despite the diplomatic uproar that might have followed the approval of so many settlements. In other words, it was sort of a trick, I guess you can call it. These outposts are neighborhoods of existing settlements. Now, 16 outposts were legalized this way, and two others were given approval as agricultural farms. In 2018, the government took the principal position of transforming the farm outpost into a settlement, a move that has not yet been completed. And last year, it began the process of transforming the Jordan Valley outpost into a settlement. In total, according to Peace Now, which is opposed, of course, to the settlement, according to Peace Now, 21 outposts have been legalized and 9 are in the process. Now, that's the left wing. On the other hand, the right-wing politicians and settlers never liked the piecemeal style of addressing the issue. because technically the communities retain an illegal status, which makes it problematic. Problematic in particular for them to receive necessary services, including funds for security, protect them from possible attacks by Palestinians. So their unauthorized status, particularly those built on private Palestinian land, also makes them vulnerable to the High Court of Justice petitions that are put that are presented to the High Court by left-wing non-governmental organizations, NGOs. Meanwhile, under Netanyahu's watch, the IDF evacuated several outposts, and homes were also demolished at other outposts. This summer, the High Court of Justice ordered the razing of homes in another outpost. So it's a reminder to settlers and the political right of the tenuous status of these communities, and the legislative attempts to resolve the issues have failed in the past. The closest the right came was back in 2017 when the Security Cabinet formed a committee to regulate the outposts, but their efforts were stymied every term, and the path to the legislation of some 70 outposts have not been achieved. They were listed in this report how to do it, but doesn't happen. At issue, in part, was the prolonged election cycle. We had three elections here in Israel in a year and a half, and no governments were formed, and the governments that were formed took time to form, and they're very shaky, so it's very difficult to get anything really done of a permanent nature under these conditions. So, on top of that, there was the promised hope of West Bank annexation, a move that settlers thought would allow for a comprehensive revolution of the issue. But now the annexation has been suspended because of the agreements with the Arab countries. So the attention of the right has once more turned to the outposts. Now, particular concern is not just the fear of further court-ordered demolitions or the absence of utilities, but the possibility that the outpost might be outside the contour of Trump's annexation map. So what is happening is that the right, and when I say right, I mean it with a capital R, is therefore pressuring Netanyahu to once more become active on this issue, particularly through a government or security cabinet decision to authorize the communities. So the right sees this as a necessary compensation for the government's failure to fulfill the annexation pledge, because the agreement with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. So now the settlers feel that they have to get some kind of compensation. So so what's happening is seeing this as a compensation, so the Trump administration's supportive policy toward Israeli rights in Judea and Samaria creates a climate that makes making these outposts legal possible. There is in the Knesset a caucus called the Land of Israel Caucus, and it is preparing legislation to support authorization of the outpost. Netanyahu and U.S. Ambassador to Israel David Friedman have both promised that no settlers would be uprooted from their homes, and the head of the Yishuv Council said that this pledge can't just be about the settlements, it must be applied to the outposts also. So in the area that Israel took control of in the 1967 war, there are settlements and there are outposts. And there are many, many settlements and many, many outposts. And the goal of the right now is to get these outposts to be legalized. The outposts were built primarily near settlements. They were like suburbs to the settlements. So this is a situation that we'll probably be hearing more about in the upcoming months, because it's important, primarily because the right has seen the government as having reneged on its promises. The government's excuse is the agreement with the other Arab countries, but the facts remain that there are a lot of places where Jews are living which are not legalized. And this will probably come to a head sometime within the next couple of months. It's a touchy situation, but I want the listeners to be aware of it. Again, it's one of those things that doesn't get into the headlines, but it is an issue that can lead to a lot of internal struggles here in Israel. Again, thanks for listening. Take care of yourselves. Till next time.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
If you're hearing this message, everyone else can too. Advertise with Israel News Talk Radio and get your message out to people. We'll build a personalized package for you. Contact advertising at israelnewstalkradio.com.
Straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Jake in Anchorage, Alaska, and I love listening to all the super interesting interviews and up-to-date information on what's happening in Israel.
Hello, this is Anna King, originally from London, now living in Israel. And what can I say? Israel News Talk Radio is my cup of tea.
My name is Bhaskar. I'm from India, and I love listening because you get to know the truth and wonderful voices from this lovely country.
Mom! Okay, wait a minute.
Hi, this is Chava Dax, and I'm calling for the rolling hills of Maale Adumim, just north of Jerusalem. I always listen to Israel News Talk Radio to get all the latest news and commentary and to keep me up to date every day.
This is Sarah Dax from Maale Adumim, and I'm 12. I wish Israel News Talk Radio was boring so my mom wouldn't listen to it all the time. Mom!
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.